We mortals can't read other people's minds directly, but we make good guesses from what they say, what we read between the lines, and reading our first exercised in the crib, two-month-old behavior. It is our species' most remarkable talent. The skills behind mind-reading are first exercised in the crib. Two-month-olds stare at eyes. Six-month-olds know when they're reading are first exercised in the crib, what a parent is staring at, and check a parent's eyes when they are uncertain why the parent is doing something. Between 18 and 24 months, children begin to separate the contents of other people's minds from their own beliefs. They show that ability in a deceptively simple feat. Pretending. When a toddler plays along with his mother, who tells him the phone is ringing and hands him a banana, he is separating the contents of their pretense, the banana is a telephone, from the contents of his own belief, the banana is a banana. Two-year-old banana is a telephone, from the contents is a telephone, from the contents of his own belief, remember. They know that a looker generally wants what he is looking at, and they grasp the idea of idea. For example, they know that you can't eat the memory of an apple and that a person can tell what's in a box only by looking into it. By four, children pass a very stringent test of knowledge about other minds. They can attribute to others beliefs they themselves know to others beliefs they themselves. In a typical experiment, children open a Smarties box and are surprised to find pencils inside. Smarties, the British psychologists explain to American audiences, are like M&Ms, only better. Then the children are asked what a person coming into the room expects to find. Though the children know that the box contains pencils, they sequester the knowledge, put themselves in the newcomer's shoes, and say, Smarties. Three-year-olds have more trouble keeping their knowledge out of the picture. They insist that the newcomer will expect to find pencils in the candy box. But it's unlikely that they lack the very idea of other minds. When the wrong answer is made less alluring, or the children are induced to think a bit, or the children attribute false beliefs to others, too. The results come out the same in every country in which children have been tested. Thinking of other minds comes so naturally that it almost seems like part and parcel of intelligence itself. Can we even imagine what it would be to think of other people as having minds? The psychologist Alison Gopnik imagines it would be like this. At the top of my field of vision is a blurry edge of nose. In front are waving hands. Around me, bags of skin are draped over chairs and stuffed into pieces of cloth. They shift and protrude in unexpected ways. Two dark spots near the top of them swivel restlessly back and forth. A hole beneath the spots fills with food, and from it comes a stream of noises. The noisy earth. A hole beneath the spot. Earth. A hole beneath the spots fills with food and... Baron Cohen, Alan Leslie, and Uta Frith have proposed that there really are Frith who think like this. They are the people we call autistic. Autism affects about 1 in 1,000 children. They are said to draw into a shell and live within themselves. When taken into a room, they disregard people and go for the objects. When someone offers a hand, they play with it like a mechanical toy. Cuddly dolls and stuffed animals hold little interest. They hold little attention to their parents and don't respond when called. In public, they touch, smell, and walk over people as if they were furniture, over people as if children. But the intellectual and perceptual abilities of some autistic children are legendary, especially after Dustin Hoffman's performance in Rain Man. Some of them learn multiplication tables, put together jigsaw puzzles, even upside down, disassemble and reassemble appliances, read distant license plates, or instantly calculate the day of the week on which any given date in the past or future falls. Like many psychology undergraduates, I learned about autism from a famous Scientific American reprint, Joey, a Mechanical American Reprint, by the psychoanalyst Bruno Bettelheim. Bettelheim explained that Joey's autism was caused by emotionally distant parents, icebox mother became the favored term, and early rigid toilet training. He wrote, "It is unlikely that Joey's calamity could befall a child in any time and culture but our own." According to Bettelheim, post-war parents had such an easy time providing their children with creature comforts that they took no pleasure in it, and the children did not develop a feeling of worth from having their basic needs satisfied. Bettelheim claimed, and the children did not have the toilet. He allowed that the therapy entailed some hardships for his counselors. Today we know that autism occurs in every country and social class, lasts a lifetime, though sometimes lasts movement, and cannot be blamed on mothers. It almost certainly has neurological and genetic causes, though they have not been pinpointed. Frith and Leslie suggest that autistic children are mind blind. Their module for attributing minds to others is damaged. Minds to autistic children almost never pretend, can't explain the difference between an apple and a memory of an apple, don't distinguish between someone's looking at the box and someone's touching it, know where a cartoon face is looking but do not guess that it wants what it is looking at, and fail the Smarties, false belief, task. Remarkably, they pass a test that is logically the same as the false belief task, but not about minds. The experimenter lifts rubber ducky out of the bathtub and puts it on the bed, takes a Polaroid snapshot and then puts it back in the bathtub. Normal 3-year-olds believe that the photo will somehow show the duck in the tub. Autistic children know it does not. Mind blindness is not caused by real blindness, nor by mental retardation, such as Down syndrome. It is a vivid reminder that the contents of the world are not just there for the knowing, but have to be grasped with suitable mental machinery. In a sense, autistic children are right. The universe is nothing but matter in motion. My normal mental equipment leaves me chronically dumbfounded at the fact that a micro dot and a spoonful of semen can bring about a sight of thinking and feeling, and that a blood clot or a metal slug can end it. It gives me the delusion that London and chairs and vegetables are on the inventory of the world's objects. The delusion that London once wrote, "Everything you've learned as obvious becomes less and less obvious as you begin to study less and less obvious. For example, there are no solids in the universe. There's not even a suggestion of a solid. There are no absolute continuums. There are no There are no straight lines." In another sense, of course, the world does have surfaces and chairs and rabbits and mind. Vortices of matter and energy that obey their own laws and ripple through the sector of space-time in which we spend our days. They are not social constructions, nor the bits of undigested beef that Scrooge blamed for his vision of Marley's ghost. To find them, they might as well not exist at all. As the psychologist George Miller has put it, the crowning intellectual accomplishment of the brain is the real world. All the fundamental aspects of the real world of our experience are adaptive interpretations of the really real world of physics. Other primates may not think about stories, inheritances, meetings, and traffic lights, but think about rocks, sticks, and burrows. Evolutionary change often works by copying body parts and tinkering with the copy. For example, insects' mouth parts are modified legs. A similar process may have given us our language of thought. Suppose ancestral circuits for reasoning about space and force were copied, the copy's connections to the eyes and muscles were severed, and references to the physical world were bleached out. The circuits could serve as a scaffolding whose slots are filled with symbols for more abstract concerns like states, possessions, ideas, and desires. The circuits would retain their computational abilities, continue to reckon about entities being in one state at a time, shifting in one state at a time, When the new abstract domain has a logical structure that mirrors object logical structure that perfect light has one color at a time but flips between them, contested social interactions are determined by the stronger of two wills. The old circuits can do useful inferential work. They divulge their ancestry as space and force simulators by the metaphors they invite, a kind of vestigial cognitive organ. A few. Chimpanzees, and presumably their common ancestor with our species, are curious manipulators. To use symbols or gestures, they can make them stand for the event of going to a place or putting an object in a location. David Primack has shown that chimpanzees can isolate causes. Given a pair of before and after pictures, like an apple and a pair of apple halves, or a scribbled sheet of paper next to a clean one, they pick out the object that wreaked the change. A knife, first case, and an eraser in the second. So, not only do chimpanzees maneuver in the physical world, but they have freestanding thoughts about it. Perhaps the circuitry behind those thoughts was co-opted in our lineage for more abstract kinds of causation. How do we know that the minds of living human beings really appreciate the parallels between, say, social and physical pressure, or between space and time? How do we know that people aren't just using dead metaphors uncomprehendingly, as when we talk of breakfast without thinking of it as breaking a fast? For one thing, space and force metaphors have been reinvented time and again in dozens of language families across the globe. Even more suggestive evidence comes from my own main field of research, child language acquisition. The psychologist Melissa Bowerman discovered that one main field of research in which space and motion symbolize possession, circumstance, time, and causation. You put me just bread and butter. Mother takes ball away from boy and puts it to girl. I'm taking these cracks bigger while shelling a peanut. I'm putting part of the sleeve blue, so I crossed it out with red. Can I have any reading behind the dinner? Today we'll be packing because tomorrow there won't be enough space to pack. Bring Saturday and Sunday, so I can't have Saturday and Sunday if I don't go through Friday. My dolly is scrunched from... not from me. They had to stop from a red light. The children could not have inherited... the two earlier speakers, the equation of space with abstract ideas, has come naturally to them. Space and force are so basic to language that they are hardly metaphors at all, at least not in the sense of the literary devices used in poetry and prose. There's no way to talk about possession, circumstance, and time in ordinary conversation without using words like going, keeping, and working at. And the words don't trigger the sense of incongruity that drives a genuine literary metaphor. We all know when we are faced with a figure of speech. As Jackendorf points out, it's natural to say, of course the world isn't really a stage, but if it were, you might say that infancy is the first act. But it would be bizarre to say, of course meetings aren't really points in motion, but if they were, you might say that this one went from 3 o'clock to 4 o'clock. Models of space and force don't act like figures of speech intended to convey new insights. I suspect that parts of our mental equipment for time, animate beings, minds, and so are copied and modified in the course of our evolution from the module for intuitive physics that we partly share with chimpanzees. Metaphors can be built out of metaphors, and we continue to borrow from concrete thoughts when we stretch our ideas and words to encompass new domains. Somewhere between the basic constructions for space and time in English and the glories of Shakespeare, there is a vast inventory of beer. There is words that express the bulk of our experience. George Lakoff and the linguist Mark Johnson have assembled a list of the metaphors and have by mental equations that embrace dozens of expressions. Argument is war. Your claims are indefensible. He attacked every weak point in my argument. Her criticisms were right on her. I've never won an argument with him. Virtue is up. He is high-minded. She is an upstanding citizen. That was a low trick. Don't be underhanded. I wouldn't stoop to that. It is beneath me. Love is a patient. This is a sick relationship. They have a healthy marriage. This marriage is dead. It can't be revived. It's a tired affair. Ideas are food. What he said left a bad taste in my mouth. All this paper has are half-baked ideas and warmed-over theories. I can't swallow that claim. That's food for thought. Once you begin to notice this pedestrian poetry, you find it everywhere. Ideas are not only food, but buildings, people, plants, products, commodities, but everywhere. Ideas are not everywhere. Ideas are not only food, but buildings. Visual field is a container. Self-esteem is a brittle object. Time is money. Life is a game of chance. Hotheads. The Romantic movement, philosophy, literature, and art began about 200 years ago, and since then the emotions and the intellect have been assigned to different realms. The emotions come from nature and live in the body. They are hot, irrational impulses and intuitions which follow the imperatives of visions, which the intellect comes from civilization and lives in the mind. It is a cool deliberator that follows the interests of keeping the emotions in check. Romantics believe that the emotions are the source of wisdom, innocence, authenticity, and creativity, and should not be repressed by individuals or society. Often, romantics acknowledge a dark side, the price we must pay for artistic greatness. When the anti-hero in Anthony Burgess's A Clockwork Orange has his violent impulses conditioned out of his violent loses his taste for Beethoven. Romanticism dominates contemporary American popular culture, as in the Dionysian cultos of rock music, the pop psychology imperative to get in touch with your feelings, and the Hollywood formulas about wise simpletons and about uptight yuppies taking a walk on the wild side. Most scientists tacitly accept the premises of romanticism even when they disagree with its morals. The irrational emotions and the repressing intellect keep reappearing in scientific guises. The id and the superego, biological drives and cultural norms, the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere, the limbic system hemisphere, the limbic system, biological our animal ancestors, and the general intelligence that propelled us to civilization. In this chapter, I present a distinctly unromantic theory of the emotions. It combines the computational theory of mind, combines that the lifeblood of the psyche is information rather than energy, with the modern theory of evolution, which calls for reverse engineering, complex design of biological systems. I will show that the emotions are adaptions, well-engineered software modules that work in harmony with the intellect and are indispensable to the functioning of the whole mind. The problem with the emotions is not that they are untamed for emotions as vestiges of our animal past. It is that they were designed to propagate copies of the genes that built them, rather than to promote happiness, wisdom, or moral values. We often call an act emotional when it is harmful to the social group, damaging to the actor's happiness in the long run, uncontrollable and impervious to persuasion, or a product of self-delusion. Sad to say, these outcomes sections, but precisely what we would expect from well-engineered emotions. The emotions has been prematurely written off as non-adaptive baggage. The neuroscientist Paul MacLean took the romantic doctrine of the emotions and translated it into a famous but incorrect theory known as the triune brain. He described the human cerebrum as an evolutionary palimpsest of three layers. At the bottom are the basal ganglia, or reptilian brain, the seat of the primitive and selfish emotions driving the four Fs, feeding, fighting, fleeing, and sexual behavior. Grafted onto it is the limbic system, or primitive mammalian brain, which is dedicated to the kinder, gentler social emotions, like the more primitive mammalian brain, which is dedicated to the neocortex that grew wild in human evolution and that houses the intellect. Our animal legacies is also familiar from pop ethology documentaries in which snarling baboons segue into snarling hooligans as the voiceover frets about whether we will rise above our instincts and stave off nuclear doom. One problem for the triune theory is that the forces of evolution do not just heap layers on an unchanged foundation. Natural selection may work with what is already around, but it can modify what it finds. Most parts of the human body came from ancient mammals, and before them ancient reptiles, but the parts were heavily modified to fit features of the human lifestyle, such as upright posture. Though our bodies carry vestiges of the past, they have few parts that were unmodifiable and adapted only to the needs of older species. Even the appendix is currently put to use by the immune system. The circuitry for the emotions was not left untouched either. Admittedly, some traits of the architectural plan of an organism that selection is powerless to tinker with them. Might the software for the emotions be burned so software for the emotion organisms are condemned to feel as their remote ancestors did? The evidence says no. The emotions are easy to reprogram. Emotional repertoires vary wildly among animals depending on their species, sex, and age. Within the mammals, we find the lion and the lamb. Even within dogs, a single species, a few millennia of selective breeding have given us pit bulls and St. Bernards. The genus closest to ours embraces common chimpanzees, in which gangs of males massacre rivals. And the pygmy chimpanzees, or bonobos, whose philosophy is make bonobos, whose Of course, some reactions are widely shared across species, say panic when one is confined, but the reactions may have been retained because they are adaptive for everyone. Natural selection may not have had complete freedom to reprogram the emotions, but it had a lot. And the human cerebral cortex does not ride piggyback on an ancient limbic system or serve as the terminus of a processing stream beginning there. The systems work in tandem, integrated by many two-way connections. The amygdala, an almond-shaped organ buried in each temporal lobe, houses the main circuits that color our experience with emotions. It receives not with emotional signals, such as of loud noises, from the lower stations of the brain, but abstract, complex information from the brain's highest centers. The amygdala, in turn, sends signals to virtually every other part of the brain, including the decision-making circuitry of the frontal lobes. Mirrors the psychology. Emotion is not just running away from a bear. It can be set off by the most sophisticated information capable of, such as reading a Dear John letter or coming home to find an ambulance in the driveway. And the emotions help to connive intricate plots for escape, revenge, ambition, and courtship. As Samuel Johnson wrote, "Depend upon it, sir, when a man knows he is to be hanged in a fortnight, it concentrates his mind wonderfully." The first step in reverse engineering the emotions is try to imagine what a mind would be like without them. Supposedly, Mr. Spock, the Vulcan mastermind, didn't have emotions. Seven-year itch that drove him back to Vulcan to spawn. But Spock's emotionlessness just amounted to his being in control, not losing his head, coolly voicing unpleasant truths, and so on. He must have been driven by some motives or goals. Something must have kept Spock from spending his days calculating pi to a quadrillion digits or memorizing the Manhattan telephone directory. Something must have impelled him to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new civilizations, and to go where no man had gone before. Presumably it was intellectual curiosity, a drive to set and solve problems, and solidarity with allies, emotions, all. And what would Spock have done when faced with a predator or an invading Klingon? Do a headstand? Presumably a part of his brain quickly mobilized his faculties to scope out how to flee and to take steps to avoid the vulnerable That is, he had fear. Spock may not have been impulsive or demonstrative, but he must have had drives that impelled but he must have had drive in pursuit of certain goals rather than others. A conventional computer program is a list of instructions. Until it reaches stop. But the intelligence of aliens, robots, and animals needs a more flexible method of control. Recall that intelligence is the pursuit of goals in the face of obstacles. Without goals, the very concept of intelligence is meaningless. To get into my locked apartment, I can force open a window, call the landlord, or try to reach the latch through the mail slot. Each of these goals is attained by a chain of sub-goals. My fingers won't reach the latch, so the sub-goal is to find pliers. But my pliers are inside, my fingers won't be buying new pliers, and so on. But where does the topmost goal, the one to attain, come from? For artificial intelligence systems, it comes from the programmer. The programmer designs soybean diseases or predict the next day's Dow Jones Industrial Average. For organisms, it comes from natural selection. The brain strives to put its owner in circumstances like those that caused its ancestors to reproduce. The brain's goal is not reproduction itself. Animals don't know the facts of life, and people who do know them are happy to subvert them, such as when they use contraception. Called in Homo sapiens that problem-solving social species are not just the four Fs. High on the list are understanding and securing the cooperation of others. And here is the key to why we have emotions. Do all its goals at once. If an animal is both hungry and thirsty, it should not stand halfway between a berry bush and a lake, as in the fable of a bush and a lake of ass who starved between two haystacks. Nor should it nibble a berry, walk over and take a sip from the lake, walk back to take a sip from the and so on. The animal must commit its body to one goal at a time, and the goals have to be matched with the best moments for achieving them. Ecclesiastes says that to everything there is a season, and a time to every purpose under heaven, a time to weep and a time to laugh. A time to love and a time to hate. Different goals are appropriate when a lion has you in its sights, when your child shows up in tears, or when a rival calls you an idiot in public. The emotions are mechanisms that set the brain's highest level goals. Once triggered by a propitious moment, an emotion triggers the cascade of sub-goals and sub-sub-goals that we call thinking and acting, that we call thinking and acting. Moment, an emotion, a multiply nested control structure of subgoals within subgoals within subgoals within our line divides thinking from feeling, nor does thinking inevitably precede feeling or vice versa, notwithstanding the century, notwithstanding over which comes first. For example, fear is triggered by a signal of impending harm, like a predator, a clifftop, or a spoken threat. It lights up the short-term goal of fleeing, subduing, or deflecting the danger, and gives the goal high priority, which experience as a sense of urgency. It also lights up the longer-term goals of avoiding the hazard in the future and remembering how we got out of it this time, remembering how we got out, we experience as relief. Most artificial intelligence researchers believe that freely behaving robots, as opposed to the ones bolted to the side of an assembly line, will have to be programmed with something like emotions merely for them to know at every moment what to do next. Fear also presses a button that readies the body for action, the so-called fight-or-flight response. The nickname is misleading because the response prepares us for any time-sensitive action, such as grabbing a baby who is crawling toward the top of a stairwell. The heart thunderwell. The heart thump is rerouted from the gut and skin, leaving butterflies and clamminess. Rapid breathing takes in oxygen. Adrenaline releases fuel from the liver and helps the blood to clot. And it gives our face that universal deer-in-the-headlights look. Each human emotion mobilizes the mind and body to meet one of the challenges of living and reproducing in the cognitive niche. Some challenges are posed by physical things, and the emotions that deal with them, like disgust, fear, and appreciation of natural beauty, The problem in dealing with people is that people can deal back. The emotions that evolve back, people's emotions, like anger, gratitude, shame, and romantic love, are played on a complicated chessboard, and they spawn the complicated chess intrigue that misleads the romantic. The expression, a fish out of water, reminds us that every animal is adapted to a habitat. Humans are no exception. We tend to think that animals just go where they belong, like heat-seeking missiles. But the animals must experience these drives as emotions not unlike ours. Some places are inviting, calming, or beautiful. Others are depressing or scary. The topic in biology called habitat selection is, in the case of Homo sapiens, the same as the topic in geologists, the architecture called environmental aesthetics, what kinds of places we enjoy being in. Until very recently, our ancestors were nomads, leaving a site when they had used up its edible plants and animals. The decision of where to go next was no small matter. Cosmides and Tubi write, imagine that you are on a camping trip that lasts a lifetime. Having to carry water from a stream and firewood from the carry water, one quickly learns to appreciate the advantages of some campsites over others. Dealing with exposure on a daily basis quickly gives one an appreciation daily basis quickly out of the wind, snow, or rain. For hunter-gatherers, there is no escape from this way of life. No opportunities to pick up food at the grocery store, no telephones, no emergency services, no artificial water supplies, no fuel deliveries, no cages, guns, or animal control officers to protect one from the predatory animals. In these circumstances, one's life depends on the operation of mechanisms that cause one to prefer habitats that provide sufficient food, water, shelter, information, and safety to support human life. Homo sapiens is adapted to two habitats. Savanna, in which most of our evolution took place. For an omnivore like our ancestors, the savanna is a hospitable place as the savanna with other ecosystems. Deserts have little biomass because they have little water. Temperate forests lock her. Temperate wood. Rainforests, or as they used to be called, jungles, place it high in the canopy, relegating omnivores on the ground, relegating others who gather the bits that fall from above. But the savanna, grasslands dotted with clumps of trees, is rich in biomass, clumps of tree, flesh of large animals, because grass replenishes itself quickly when grazed. And most of the biomass is conveniently placed a meter from the ground. Savannas also offer expansive views, so predators, water, and paths can be spotted from afar. Paths, trees provide shade and an escape from carnivores. Our second choice habitat is the rest of the world. Our ancestors wandered into almost every nook and cranny of the planet. Some were pioneers who left the savanna, and then other areas in turn, as the population expanded or the climate changed. Others were refugees in search of safety. Foraging tribes can't stand one another. They frequently raid neighboring territories and kill any stranger who blunders into theirs. We could afford this wanderlust because of our intellect. People explore a new landscape and draw up a mental resource map, rich in details about water, plants, animals, roots, and shelter. And if they can, they make their new homeland into a savanna. Native Americans and Australian Aborigines used to burn huge swaths. New homeland in grasses. The ersatz savanna attracted grazing animals, which were eaten and exposed visitors before they got too close. The biologist George Oriens, an expert on the behavioral ecology of birds, recently turned his eye to the behavioral ecology of humans. With Judith Heerwagen, Stephen Kaplan, Rachel Kaplan, and others, he argues that our sense of natural beauty is the mechanism that drove our ancestors into suitable habitats. We innately find landscape that is easy to explore and remember, and that we have lived in long enough to know its ins and outs. In experiments on human habitat preference, American children and adults are shown slides of landscapes and asked how much they would like to visit or live in them. The children prefer savannas, even though they have never been to one. The adults like the savannas too, but they like the deciduous and coniferous forests, which resemble much of the habitable United States, just as much. No one likes the deserts and the rainforests. That the children are revealing our species' default habitat preference, and the adults supplement it with the land with which they have grown familiar with. Of course, people do not have a mystical longing for ancient homelands. They are merely pleased by the landscape features they are merely tend to have. Oriens and Heerwagen surveyed the professional wisdom of gardeners, photographers, and painters to learn what kinds of landscapes people find beautiful. They treated it as a second kind of data on human tastes in habitats, supplementing the experiments on people's reactions to slides. The landscapes thought to be the loveliest, they found, are dead ringers for an optimal savanna. Semi-open space, neither completely exposed, which leaves one vulnerable, nor overgrown, which impedes vision and movement. Even ground cover, view leaves one vulnerable, changes in elevation, and multiple paths leading out. The geographer J. aptly captured what makes a landscape appealing. Prospect and refuge, or seeing without being seen. Land safely. The land itself must be legible, too. Anyone who has lost a trail in dunes or snowdrifts in all directions knows the terror of an environment lacking a frame of reference. A landscape is just a very big object, and we recognize complex objects by locating their parts in a reference frame belonging to the object. The reference frames are big landmarks, like trees, rocks, and ponds, and long paths or boundaries, like rivers and mountain ranges. A vista without these guideposts is unsettling. Kaplan and Kaplan found another key to natural beauty, which they call mystery. Paths bending around hills, meandering streams, gaps in foliage, undulating land, and partly blocked views grab our interest by hinting that the land may have important features that could be discovered by further exploration. People also love to look at animals and plants, as well as flowers. If you are reading this book at home or in other pleasant but artificial surroundings, chances are you can look up and find animal, plant, or flower motifs in the decorations. Our fascination with animals is obvious. We eat them, they eat us. But our love of flowers, which we don't eat except in salads in overpriced restaurants, needs an explanation. People are intuitive botanists, and a flower is a rich source of data. Plants blend into a sea of green and often can be identified only by their flowers. Flowers are harbingers of growth into a sea of green creatures smart enough to remember them. Some natural happenings, like sunsets, thunder, gathering clouds, and fire. Oriens and Heerwagen note that they tell of an imminent and constant that change. Darkness, a storm, a blaze. The emotions evoked are arresting, forcing one to stop thing and prepare for what's to come. Environmental aesthetics is a major factor in our lives. Mood depends on surroundings. Think of being in a bus terminal waiting room or a lakeside cottage. People's biggest purchase is their home. People's biggest pools of home buying, location, location, and location, pertain, apart from nearness to amenities, to grassland, trees, bodies of water, and prospect. Views. The value of the house itself depends on its refuge, cozy spaces, and mystery, nooks, bends, windows, multiple levels. And people in the unlikeliest of ecosystems strive for a patch of savanna to call their own. In New England, any land that is left alone quickly turns into a scruffy, deciduous forest. During my interest, every weekend, my fellow burghers and I would drag out our lawn mowers, leaf blowers, weed whackers, limb loppers, branch prune, limb loppers, nippers, hedge clippers, and wood chippers in a Sisyphean effort to hold the forest at bay. Here in Santa Barbara, the land wants to be an arid chaparral, but decades ago the city fathers dammed wilderness creeks and tunneled through mountains to bring water to thirsty lawns. During a recent drought, homeowners were so desperate for verdant vistas that they sprayed their dusty yards with green paint. Language lovers know that there is a word for every fear. Are you afraid of wine? Then you have enophobia. Wine? Then you have enophobia. Language lovers know you suffer from siderodromophobia. Having misgivings about your mother-in-law is having misgithrophobia. And being petrified of peanut butter sticking to the roof of your mouth is arachibutyrophobia. Franklin Delano Roosevelt's affliction, the fear of fear itself, or phobophobia. But just as not having a word for an emotion doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, having a word for an emotion doesn't mean that it does exist. Word watchers, verbopedalians love a challenge. Their idea of a good time is to find the shortest word that contains all the vowels in alphabetical order, or to write a novel without the letter E. Yet another joy of Lex is finding names for hypothetical fears. That is where these improbable phobias come from. Real people do not tremble at the referent of every euphonious Greek or Latin root. Fears and phobias fall into a short and universal list. Snakes and spiders are always scary. They are the most common objects of fear and loathing in studies of college students' phobias, and have been so for a long time in our evolutionary history. D.O. Hebb found that chimpanzees born in captivity scream in terror when they first see a snake, and the primatologist Mark Hauser found that his laboratory-bred cotton-top tamarins, a South American monkey, screamed out alarm calls when they saw a piece of plastic tubing on the floor. The reaction of foraging peoples is succinctly put by Irvin DeVore. Hunter-gatherers will not suffer a snake to live. In cultures that revere snakes, people still treat them with great wariness. Even Indiana Jones was afraid of them. Cultures that revere snakes, worms, large carnivores, darkness, blood, strangers, confinement, deep water, social scrutiny, and leaving home alone. The common thread is obvious. These are the situations that put our evolutionary ancestors in danger. Spiders and snakes are often venomous, especially in Africa, and most of the others are obvious hazards to a forager's health, or in the case of foragers' health, status. Fear is the emotion that motivated our ancestors to cope with the dangers they were likely to face. There is probably several emotions. Phobias of physical things, of social scrutiny, and of leaving home respond to different kinds of drugs, by different brain circuits. The psychiatrist Isaac Marks has shown that people react in different ways to different frightening things, in different ways action appropriate to the hazard. An animal triggers an urge to flee, but a precipice causes one to freeze. Social threats lead to shyness and gestures of appeasement. People really do faint at the sight of blood because their blood pressure drops, presumably a response that would minimize the further loss of one's own blood. The best evidence that fears are adaptations and not just bugs in the nervous system is that bugs that have evolved on islands without predators lose their fear and are sitting ducks for any invader. Hence the expression, dodo. Fears in modern city dwellers protect us from dangers that no longer exist and fail to protect us from dangers in the world around us. We ought to be afraid of guns, driving fast, driving without a seatbelt, lighter fluid, and hair dryers near bathtubs, not of snakes and spiders. Public safety officials try to strike fear in the hearts of citizens using everything from statistics to shocking photographs, usually to no avail. Parents scream and punish to deter to shocking photographs, usually to no avail. Children were asked what they were most afraid of. They cited lions, tigers, and snakes. Unlikely tigers in the Windy City. Of course, fears do change with experience. For decades, you fears the way Pavlov's dogs learned to salivate to a bell. In a famous experiment, John B. Watson, the founder of behaviorism, came up behind an 11-month-old boy playing with a tame white rat and suddenly clanged two steel bars together. After a few more clangs, the boy became afraid of the rat and other white furry things, including rabbits, dogs, a sealskin coat, and Santa Claus. To associate danger with a previously neutral stimulus. A rat shocked in a white room will flee it for a black room every time it is dumped there, long after the shocker has been unplugged. But in fact, creatures cannot be conditioned to fear just any old thing. Children are nervous about rats, and rats are nervous about bright rooms before any conditioning begins, and they easily associate them with danger. Change the white rat to some arbitrary object, like opera glasses, and the child never learns to fear it. Shock the rat in a black room, a white one, and that nocturnal creature learns the association more slowly and unlearns it more quickly. The psychologist Martin Seligman suggests that fears can be easily conditioned only when the animal is evolutionarily prepared to make the association. Few, if any, human phobias are about neutral objects that were once paired with some trauma. People dread snakes without ever having seen one. After a frightening or painful event, people are more prudent around the cause, but they do not fear it. Television clichés notwithstanding, most survivors of a traumatic event do not get the screaming memes every time they face a reminder of it. Vietnam veterans resent the stereotype in which they hit the dirt whenever someone drops a glass. A better way to understand the learning of fears is to think through the evolutionary demands. The world is a dangerous place. The warriors could not have spent their lives cowering in caves. There was food to gather and mates to win. They had to calibrate their fears of dangers against the actual dangers in the local environment. After all, not all spiders are poisonous. And against their own ability to neutralize the danger, their know-how, defensive technology, and safety in numbers. End of side 6. Please turn to side 7.